Mini episode 82 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by the Pullins Group, delivering public affairs consulting and marketing services for small businesses trying to grow. Follow them on the web at PullinsGroup.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 82. A very special occasion. We have three FDH Lounge original dignitaries back together. Myself, Rick Morris, along with FDH Senior Editor Jason Jones and FDH Director of Research Nathan Noy. I'm going to set up for you what we've got going on here. This is a very, very special occasion to be able to do this. It's the hottest story in the world right now, sports or otherwise. Today we're bringing you the great Jeremy Lin debate. And specifically, we have our two antagonists set up here, and I just want to outline the dimensions of what we have here, because it is really very unique. On the one hand, we have the optimist. That would be Jason Jones, FDH senior editor. He's our lead NBA and NFL draft analyst since 2006. His foundation is in scouting, and you'll hear when he's talking here, he's really got kind of a database in his head from over the years of different players, player attributes, etc. And he makes a lot of comparisons and cross-references in that way. He also looks at statistics, but his foundation really is on the scouting and the visual end. On the other side of the equation, our pessimist, Nathan Noy, FDH Director of Research. His primary grounding is in the statistical side of it. That's his foundation. Now, he also watches a lot of games. Ironically, right now, he's probably watching more games than me and Jason put together, because he's got the package on his phone and he's watching games every night. His emphasis is primarily on the statistical side. So that's part of the reason that these guys are coming at it from different sides, but it's not the only reason. But it's going to be a really, really excellent debate here. I'm going to finish setting it up in a moment, but first let me bring them both in, Jason Jones and Nate Noy. Guys, good to have you guys both on. How you doing tonight?
Not bad, Rick.
Doing great, Rick, but I beg to differ. I'm not the pessimist. I'm the realist in this debate.
Okay.
There's a big difference.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to have a lot of time to cover that here, albeit, I'm just going to say this again, not as much time as we would like under the circumstances. So I ask our participants here to look at this accordingly and to prioritize in terms of the arguments that they have. I myself, I'm going to be mostly a bystander here, just kind of steering the ship. I'll say at the outset, I'm more on Jason's side of the argument than on Nate's. I don't have much to offer aside from reacting, aside from when we get to the part about turnovers. I've done a little bit of research myself on turnovers. I'm sure we'll get to that in due time. Let's lead this off with Jason. Jason, if you can, take about 3 minutes or so, set up the case for Jeremy Lin and why you are as bullish on him as you are.
Well, first off, the kid's fun to watch, and I think that draws people in. But when you really get into it, there are a few aspects I think you look for in every point guard. And for me, the most exciting of all of them is something I call flow and feel. When you watch them with the ball, when they dribble up the court, when they go through screens, when they're running the offense, does it feel like he has to stop and think about every move, or is it second nature? This came up in previous conversations that we've had about a number of guards, and I will specifically highlight Steve Nash and John Wall in that regard. He has that. He also, my favorite factor, is he's got an amazing sense of fundamental form. The way he dribbles the ball is almost a throwback to the point guards of the 50s. His body is always in control. He's upright. There's not a lot of lateral movement. Every movement he makes is premeditated and in control. His shot is amazing. I mean, second to, let's say, Ray Allen. He's got the Ken Griffey Jr. of jump shots, if you will, referring to Griffey's baseball swing. It's absolutely pretty, and it is going to be more effective more often than not because of that. Now, there are some issues that are of a concern. He's not exactly the fastest guy, the most athletic guy, but we've seen that works just fine. That's really not as much of a concern. So trying to put a bow on this whole thing, he's got the fundamental pieces already in place. He's already a solid basketball player. There's a lot of things that need to be refined, but all in all, you take everything we've seen to this point and put in together 7 wins in a row, averaging an obscene stat line. I have no reason to believe that not only is he going to be in the league for a while, but he'll be a starting point guard for a very long time.
Well, that's very interesting, and it's, of course, very reminiscent of the great John Wall debate that we had on the show previously. And again, we've got some sound for that from when you had broken down the game of John Wall at that time.
When it comes to guards like this, I've got a relatively good track record. Rick, you'll recall that as we prepared for draft day, I believe it was 05, if I'm not mistaken, and I said to some conjecture that Chris Paul would not only be the best point guard in the draft, but he'd be the best point guard in the league within 3 years. And I think it's safe to assume that that's true.
And
absolutely.
At this point here, let's throw it to Nate. Nate, you've got your notes that I know that you were preparing coming into this thing here. Jason made his opening statement. I have to say, from my perch, there doesn't appear to be a whole lot to disagree with there in Jason's thoughts. But where do you take it from there, Nate?
Okay, well, first, I agree with Jason. With it comes to the form he has and the feel and his ball control, he looks like a really good guy from a pickup game. That's how I see Jeremy Lin. He does not have the first step. He does not have the quickness. He can't get off the screen quick enough to defend. He simply does not have what you need in the NBA for a starting point guard. His range is suspect. He's shooting 20% from three. Okay, so he hits shots from 16 to 14. He better be able to hit a three once in a while as a point guard. He can't do that. His ball control skill is horrendous. He's a serious defensive liability, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And he's the product of what has been a lot of luck so far. The schedule they've played is a major factor in why he's been so successful. And again, I'll break down the schedule in a minute. But, you know, Jeremy Lin, I'd like to know, A, where would Jason rank him right now in terms of the top 150, 200 players in the NBA, and B, you know, I guess he said he expects to see him as a long-term starting point guard in the NBA. So I guess I have to answer, what do you think his NBA career is? And then C, with Jeremy Lin and get Melo and Amari back here, Amari's back already, what do you see the Knicks doing with Lin this year, and what do you see the Knicks doing long-term?
All right, Jason, take those questions.
First, and maybe we should set this out of the jump, okay? You cannot, and I hope this doesn't mess up everyone's research, you cannot judge him on the entire season's body of work or his career body of work. Otherwise, you're throwing around what politics refers to as soft numbers. He's not shooting 20% from three. He's shooting about 55% from three when you factor in games that matter, otherwise known as games where he played more than 25 minutes. He's a rhythm guy. It stinks, but he's a guy that has to have the ball in his hand and has to play a majority of minutes.
No,
I agree with that. I don't think you can mix the garbage time minutes in there. And I hadn't realized that's what Nate was doing. But
I am not doing that, actually, Rick. I am not doing that. Here are three numbers for the games that mattered: 0-for-4 against New Jersey, 1-for-3 against Utah, 0-for-3 against Washington, 2-for-4 against the Lakers, 0-for-3 against Minnesota, 2-for-2 against Toronto. That's 5-for-25. That's 25%. 20%.
Okay.
5-for-20 in the games that matter. So 25% in the games that matter. Everything I've looked at for Jeremy Lin, I've only looked at the 7 games. I've completely given him the benefit of the doubt and discounted everything that happened before he became a sensation.
I stand corrected. Nate, I'm sure you can answer this off the top of your head. What's his percentage in the three-point percentage in the last 2 seconds of a game?
Well, probably 50% because he missed one. In the last 2 seconds, yeah, maybe 100. Last 10 seconds, I think 50. Again, you know, and the other thing Jason said I forgot to point out, he's fun to watch. I agree. Fun to watch does not directly correlate to wins in the NBA. We're talking about the NBA. Fun to watch. Yay. Hooray. I like the guy, too. I'm not hating on him. He's fun to watch. I agree. Doesn't mean they're going to win basketball games with this guy.
Well,
back to my other questions. You know, what do you see him doing long term? What do you see the Knicks doing this year? And, you know, that's really what I want to see, and then I'll get into how I feel about him on those issues.
Okay. Rank, I know this is the one that everyone's waiting on. I went ahead and pulled up, and believe me, this is not statistical. This is just me looking at names and trying to find out where I think he slots. And I have him at number 36. Right now, assuming that his stat line deteriorates by about 30%, which would put him at about 17 points a game, 7 assists, 3 or 4 rebounds, you know, maybe a steal and a half if we're lucky. And at that rate, I put him between Carlos Boozer and Gerald Wallace. As far as the point guards, that puts him in the scope of Kyle Lowry, and Kyrie Irving, roughly. And that's assuming that Kyrie Irving's not going to blow up beyond where he is right now. I'm holding out judgment on that because I'm thinking he's going to get a lot better than he is right now. As far as the Knicks in general, they're not moving him. I can tell you that. There's no way on this earth they would move him. I think he's going to have at least a 10-year career. What that means, I don't think he's going to be, you know, an 8-time All-Star or anything. But as far as being on the Knicks and being successful, I think they'll be fine, especially when you factor in Melo and Amari coming in, because it creates a dynamic that takes a lot of pressure off of them. I still think he can put up the numbers that we're talking about. And just to throw out some names, because the overall issue here is he a bust? Is he not going to play in the league? Does he not have what it takes? Or does he? And I would submit the fact that he plays for the Knicks. The Knicks have kept players like Tony Douglas, Chris Duhon, Nate Robinson, Marty Collins, Stephon Marbury, Steve Francis, Penny Hardaway, and Charlie Ward, all of which probably twice as long as they should have. So if he's ever going to survive the rigors of the NBA, it would be on the Knicks. So he's not going anywhere. I think he'll be the starting point guard. And I think even if he goes down and does worse than we're projecting him to do, he's still going to be with the Knicks for at least 3 years at minimum and probably bounce around the league after that. Now, I don't think he's going to deteriorate, but that's a whole different debate.
Interesting. Well, and as far as the predictions go, you're saying 36 approximately. I'm saying somewhere in the ballpark of top 50. I know Nate's probably going to come in lower than that. My guess for his stat line going forward, probably a 4 or 15 points. 11 assists. I think he's going to be good for double-digit assists when you look at the chodes that he's been playing with thus far once he's got Amari and Carmelo in the lineup there. But, Nate, I know that you're coming in more pessimistic probably than either of our tallies or more realistic as you would slate it.
Yeah, I don't have him in my top 100 players, Rick. I don't think he starts for anybody else in the NBA. Not by the end of the season. Not by the end of what he's exposed for by the end of the season. I agree with I'm putting him at 11 to 12 points at best the rest of the way. The 7 assists will come because D'Antoni will play him 38 to 40 minutes a night if he can. And by virtue of getting the ball to other players that make shots, you get assists in the NBA. So, you know, if he's going to handle the ball 40% of the time, 40 to 60% of the time he's going to have the ball in his hands, yeah, he'll have 7 assists a game. How could he not? Just by the
Great
fact
system.
They're going to make shots. He's
just
not a starter.
Steve Nash about the system.
He's not a starter. He's not an NBA quality starter. We want to get into why I think that. First of all, let's look at what the Knicks have done the last 7 games, okay? Before these 7 games, the Knicks were 8-15. They were 6-6 against teams that don't currently have a winning record. They were 2-9 against teams that do have a winning record in the NBA right now today. 2-9. Those 7 games, they beat 6 teams out of 7 that do not have a winning record. So they beat 6 bad teams. Now, maybe you call the T-Wolves a mediocre team and the Jazz a mediocre team. T-Wolves are 500 right now. Jazz are 2 games under. They did beat 1 team with a winning record. Everybody in the world saw it last Friday. but again, with an asterisk. They beat the Lakers at home. The Lakers are 5-10 this year on the road, and the night before, they were coming off the end of a long East Coast road trip. The night before, they went to overtime against Boston. They had to flip it around and play against the Knicks, and they got beat. They beat a 5-10 team on a long road trip coming off an overtime game the night before. They've not beaten anybody. All right, there's my first problem. When I look at the rest of this season, I projected out where I see the Knicks. At best, every assumption quite, the Knicks are going to finish with 35 wins, 31 losses. At best, they're four games over 500. And that's going to get them to 7 or the 8 seed. They're going to get in the playoffs. They're going to play either the Bulls or the Heat, and there's no chance they're going to win more than one game in that series. They're going to be out in the first round in 5. That's how I see the rest of the season coming. By the end of next year, D'Antonio is fired. Because the Knicks will not be good enough to make the playoffs with Jeremy Lin as their starting point guard. They will not make the playoffs, at best a 7 or 8 seed again. D'Antonio's fired for sure, and either Lin or Melo will no longer be on that team as well by the end of next year. And by the end of next year, Jeremy Lin's no longer starting in the NBA. Yeah, because of his international sensation, because of his popularity, he will stick around for 2 or 3 extra years in the NBA as a backup like a J.J. Barea. But he is no better than a J.J. Barea. That's where his ceiling is. He is a guy that might be able to stick around because of his, like you said, his form and his feel. He doesn't have the speed. He doesn't have the first step. He can't get off the screen fast enough to defend. And there's ball control and defensive liability issues I'll talk about in a moment. But I'll let you guys react to that.
Well, Nate, I want to start by asking you a follow-up in terms of what Jason said at the outset here. When Jason was listing all the different attributes, all the things about the shot that he has, all the things about the passing ability that he has really developed, because he certainly wasn't a pure point guard by any stretch of the imagination in college, and that's one of the things that dinged him when it came time for the draft. When it comes down to all the things that he can do and what he's shown thus far about the ability of a point guard with these skills to thrive in a D'Antoni offense, much as Steve Nash did in Phoenix. I'm not comparing him to Nash, but these have been Nash-like efforts that he's had recently. I think that's fair to say. How can you discount all of these things to downgrade him to that level? I'm just curious.
Okay, first of all, the turnovers, Rick. In the 6 games he started, he's had 36 turnovers. The opposing point guards in those 6 games have had 12 turnovers total. Lin's had 36, the opposition point guards 12. 3-1 ratio on the turnovers, Rick. He has the record. After 5 games, he had the record for most turnovers in the first 5 starts in the NBA history with 30. Now he has the record for most turnovers for first 6 games in NBA history if it starts at 36. The reason nobody's ever had 36 turnovers in 6 games is their first 6 starts, because if they had that many turnovers, they sure the hell wouldn't get back on the court again, ever. They would not get to start. But because of the situation, he's getting run back out there. You cannot turn the ball over 6 times a game, Rick, against good teams in the NBA. Yeah, you can get away with it against the Raptors and the Wizards and, you know, the Nets. You can get away with it against those teams, but the schedule is coming up. They're going to play Dallas on Sunday. He has 6 turnovers against Dallas. They're beat. They're going to play the Heat on Thursday. He has 6 turnovers against the Heat. They're beat. Then they have a schedule coming up where they play the Bulls and the Celtics. They're going to get beat. They're going to get beat. They're going to get beat. At best, they're going to win 34 games and get smoked in the playoffs if he's anywhere close to 6 turnovers a game. 6 turnovers a game is mind-blowing. The record for the season, Artis Gilmore in the mid-80s had like a 384 turnover season in 82 games. So, you know, 4.5, the record. The most turnovers anybody's ever survived in the history of the NBA is like 4.5. This guy's averaging 6.
Okay.
I mean, and I'll let you turn over the turnover thing, then we'll talk about the defensive liability issues.
All right, yeah. I got to jump in here because I got to ask you another follow-up, and I certainly want to get time to get Jason's reaction here, but I have to play counterpart with you here, or counterpoint, I should say, on the thing with turnovers based on the research that I did. You and I were musing the other day off air. How do you compare turnovers to other sports here? Clearly they're not as damaging as interceptions or fumbles. How do they stack up versus strikeouts? Where do they come out in the mix here as far as things in other sports that are damaging? I did a little bit of research. Let's just say on average, if you take the midpoint of the league, strangely enough, it comes out to about 95 possessions per game and about 95 points per game for teams. So you're looking at essentially 1 point per possession on average. Some teams do better, some teams do worse. If he has 3 more turnovers a game than anybody else, and all those turnovers are converted upon, that's 3 additional points that they're yielding on the defensive end, never mind everything he's doing on the offensive end with points and with assists. So that's one thing I want to throw out to you. The other thing is, if you look at the all-time turnovers record, number 2 all-time, John Stockton, number 3, Jason Kidd, number 5, Isaiah Thomas. So take it away on turnovers again.
Well, yeah, I agree. When you have the ball a lot, you turn the ball over a lot. The other problem, though, is out of those 36 turnovers in those same 6 games, he's had 57 assists, Rick. 57, that sounds like a nice big number, right? 9.5 a game. Problem is, that's a 1.58 ratio. You go back to those guys you just looked at, I guarantee their ratio was 3-1 minimum. So, yeah, they had a lot of turnovers. They had 3 times as many assists as they do turnovers. Right now, Jeremy Lin has 1.58 assists per turnover. You cannot survive with that kind of ratio in the NBA.
Okay.
The other thing, though, Rick, is there's a stat.
I don't see him catching the mailman Malone either.
No, well, there's another stat that it's per 100 possessions, offensive value and defensive value. His range is not that bad right now, but again, these numbers, which I didn't calculate, take into account his whole season. So when we get further in the season, they'll be more weighted towards what he's done. His value on the court right now is 100 points a game per 100 possessions. In contrast, LeBron's is 119. His given away points a game, defensive liability is 103 points a game to get scored against them when he's on the court. LeBron's 97. So he only gives up 97 more, but three more. But LeBron's ratio, his is a plus 22. Jeremy Lin on this scoring system is a minus 3. So you put Jeremy Lin on the court over the course of 100 possessions, you will be outscored by 3 points according to that number. And,
yeah,
and again, I've got more to go on a defensive liability. We're kind of crunched, but I wanted to get Jason back in here.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. Jason, take the next couple minutes here and react to whatever points you found most salient to address from Nate.
Well, the first thing I'll just hit on, and we'll kind of walk away from and agree to disagree kind of thing. He does have a first step, and Mike Brown came out after that Laker game and said that was one of the reasons they seriously considered trying to get him when he was a free agent, but that's really not a big deal. As far as the turnovers go, there's a lot I want to say, and in the effort of time, both with that and I will concede defensive liability. I don't even know if we need to debate that. He is a defensive liability, end of discussion. But looking at turnovers, in my opinion, you can't Billy Bean this thing. Turnovers are an issue, but when dealing with point guards, specific point guards as opposed to any other position on the floor, it is a assist to turnover ratio, which Nate hit on a little bit ago. Now, the unfair nature of this whole thing is that we're talking about 7 games versus other players' career numbers, and I'm just using that as a point of reference. But the number I came up with, and I could be wrong, but the number I came up with was 1.7, not 1.5, but not that it matters. Other names of players that are in that range: Steve Francis, Allen Iverson, Terry Porter, Reggie Theus, Alvin Robertson, Terrell Brandon are all around 2 or less. There's only a handful of guys that are in the 3s, to be honest with you, and they're all phenomenal, no doubt about it, first ballot Hall of Famers. Magic Johnson didn't even average 3 assists per 3-point assist-to-turnover ratio for his career. So I think, first off, we're dealing with numbers that are sort of ambiguous. The other thing is, we all accept he's not going to average 25 points a game. So, similarly, we would have to assume that he's not going to average 6 turnovers for his career. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, a little bit of regression here. And I did a little looking last night and found out that if you take the worst statistical turnover year that any player has, point guard-wise, then look at the rest of his career, the difference between that worst year and their career average comes back about 1.4. So if that's true, then we're looking at something like 3.8, which is still very high. But 3.8 is doable. And then his assist-to-turnover ratio becomes something like 2.2 to 2.4, which is right in the wheelhouse of more than half of the point guards in the NBA right now. So my initial thought is, the turnovers are ugly right now, and that's the first thing anybody would go to with a brainstem. However, I find a hard time sticking to that because yes, you've got the sixes and the eights, but you still have games where he played 25, 35 minutes and he only had two turnovers. So maybe it's system, maybe it's, you know, the first stretch of games he's actually played in. I'm sure that number's going to come back a little bit. He'll always be turnover prone, I'm sure, but it won't be to the point where you will say, oh, he's got to go because he commits too many turnovers. Also, no player in the history of the NBA that played the point guard has ever been let go because of turnovers. They've been let go because they can't shoot the ball and commit turnovers, or can't pass the ball and commit turnovers, or can't handle the ball. No one would ever tell a guy that's averaging 20 points and, let's say, 7 assists to hit the bricks because you gave away the ball 6 times. I think we're being a little – there's a little hyperbole with that.
I think so, and we're winding down on time here, but, Nate, there's not only that but also the notion, and you and I have talked about this off-air a little bit as well, this kid's learning that system on the fly, and yes, it's a point guard-friendly system and it allows him to be really good, but he didn't have training camp, he didn't have anything, he had to come in, learn this thing as he's been going. It's been 2 weeks to this point. I think that any kind of rational analysis here has to include the assumption that he's going to get more familiar with it and learn from some of these mistakes as he's going along.
Right, Rick, I'm saying he's a backup point guard in the NBA. Our ceilings are just way off on this. And, yes, his turnovers will come down. First of all, they had his minutes have to come down. But I've got to get in on a defensive liability here, okay? The okay. 6 games that he started, the average of the 6 point guards that he played against on the season, counting all games, 24.8 field goals made out of 59.9 field goals attempted. The Jeremy Lin games, 40 for 80. That is an increase of 15.2 field goals made and 19.9 shots made. So a 61.3% increase for field goals made for starting point guards that play against Jeremy Lin. They go from averaging 24 shots total to 40 shots total. They're shooting 50%. As a group, they shot 41.4% for the season against everybody else. 50% against Jeremy Lin, 5 points a game more for every point guard. The average point guards, the average for the season for these 6 guys was 70.2. For those 6 games, they've scored 100 points. That's a 5-point-a-game average extra for the point guard. He's a significant defensive liability so far, major defensive liability. So if you put him on the court, he turns the ball over twice more than anybody else. The opposing point guard scores 5 more points than if anybody else was on the court. You're beat. He's a backup point guard because of those numbers. And long term, that's where he will be. And like I said, the Knicks have no chance to get out of the first round this year. They're going to be done in 5.
Nate, before I throw it to Jason for a quick last word, quick reaction from you here. Lin, of course, is a long 6'3", as has been said. The other night at the end of the game, they put Shepard on Calderon and shut him down. What's to say that you couldn't put Lin on the shooting guards instead, and if the point guards will light him up?
Here's the problem, Rick, and, you know, that's exactly what happened. Jose Calderon lit him up for 25 in the first 3 quarters.
Right.
Antonio made an adjustment, and Calderon didn't score again because it's Jose Calderon. He scored 25 points. He averages 11.1.
Right.
I mean, that's insane.
Right.
Problem is, Rick,
they adjusted.
That the shooting – no, here's the problem, though. You adjust him off the point guard. Guess what? He's on the shooting guard who averages, what, 6'5", 6'6", against the 6'3 Lin. Now your defensive liability goes from what the point guard's going to do against you to what the shooting guard's going to do against you. He's just going to be lighting you up because Lin can't get past the screen. He doesn't have the speed to get over there and guard the guy.
I disagree. I think he's long enough, but that's just my thought. Jason, take about 60 seconds or so here and sum it all up on the optimist case.
Well, first off, my initial response to all of this, quite simply, is if we're in the room, there's going to be a guy who's going to present the numbers that Nate's been presenting as part of the equation. And then you're going to have coaches and scouts and all these other people who are going to say, that's fine, but the guy can play. And that's all that really matters. I think at the end of the day, the guy can play. He gets Nick players involved. Otherwise, wouldn't be. Another big point that will not be supported by stats, but you drop 38 on the Lakers, I'll give a damn what their record is on the road. It's the Lakers. He's going up against 2 7-footers, and he drops 38. I've never heard of a player that's done that, that's not had at least an 8-year-plus career. Beyond that, he is a scoring point guard. He is in the vein of a poor man's Allen Iverson. I hate to throw that name around because he's not that good, but maybe like a Steve Francis he falls in line with. There's a lot of things to say. The kid can play. And I like what you said, Rick, about it's seven games. Give this kid, you know, why aren't people giving him the Tebow treatment? Yeah, he's got some stuff he needs to fix. Give him a whole training camp. Give him a whole offseason. Let him get with coaches. Let's see what happens and not throw this kid up the creek. I think it's absurd to think that he's not in the 20s as starting point guards, which would put him in a starting position. The kid can play. You know, you watch him play. I don't care myself too much for the situational stats.
Right.
I just know the kid can play, and I think if we revisit this, we're going to find out that the truth is somewhere in the middle. I personally believe they'll be challenging for a fourth seed in the East. What that means, I don't know.
So.
But we'll see what happens. I think if I'm right, and I hope I am, that later on we'll go, wow, Nate was screaming that the sky is falling. But we'll see.
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how it shakes out. You and I are certainly more optimistic on that end of the spectrum, and you even more so than me. But, again, this has been absolutely tremendous, as I knew it would be. Jason Jones, FDH Senior Editor, Nate Noy, FDH Director of Research, breaking it down here, both sides of the Jeremy Lin debate. Gentlemen, there was a reason I was hyping this thing, because I knew it was going to be this great. Thank you both for bringing it as strong as you did.
Thanks, Rick, and let's look at this again at the end of the year when they play some teams that are actually decent.
All right.
I can't wait for it.
We'll revisit when it's done. Thanks, fellas. All right, and you've been listening, everybody, to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 82, The Great Jeremy Lin Debate.